Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. My guest today is Connor Melander. Connor is the guitarist, vocalist, and keyboardist for the Montreal indie band Half Moon Run. The band debuted with their 2012 album Dark Eyes, which was very successful both commercially and critically. They just finished recording their third album, and I spoke to Connor a couple of weeks before they hit the road for a big tour that spans over this summer and fall, and it takes them across Canada, the US, and Europe. As you'll hear, Connor is thoughtful and introspective and has a lot to say about art and creativity, the music business, psychology, and mindfulness. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Connor Melander. Connor Melander, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I just learned that I wasn't exactly pronouncing your name right. How do you say it in the proper Scandinavian pronunciation?
I think it's Molander. Wow. When I say that to Swedish people, their eyes light up.
Is your background Swedish?
My great-grandfather was born in Sweden, and he emigrated in the 30s. Other than that, I'm mostly German in my background.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Maybe you can get us started by telling us who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a musician. I'm one of the members of a band called Half Moon Run from Montreal, and I've been doing that for almost 10 years. I grew up in British Columbia, and I moved to Montreal actually to go to McGill. After high school, I applied to McGill, and I got in actually into the psychology department, and part of me thought I wanted to be a teacher, and part of me thought that I would be a psychologist like you. It was only a few months after I moved to Montreal that I met the guys in the band. When I was a teenager, I loved playing music. I was always trying to start little projects, but everybody tells you that it's not a good idea to try to rely on that as a career and to have a backup plan and all those things. So I never really believed that it was a viable option, although some part of me thought that I could maybe pull it off if I met the right people. And so that was why I moved. I decided to go to university here in Montreal because it's got that great reputation of being a center of the arts and all that. And somehow, luckily, I did meet people right away that I found to be great collaborators. I met the singer Devin through a Craigslist ad,
which no
way. Was like crazy, hey? I remember the first jam that we had was maybe 3 months after I moved to Montreal, and it was really great. It was really different. I was 19, and I'd had chances before jamming with people, you know, when I was a teenager and all that. And usually what happens is that everybody plays, tries to show how good they are, you know, and so they play loud and they play often. But I found with this group of people right away that everybody was listening and the room was really quiet. And that was the first indication that there was real chemistry there. But then the other thing that these people were that they were really focused and had a sense that if we want to do this, then we really have to do it. So right away, there was a pressure on my university, endeavors. It was only after 1 year that I had to basically decide between the two things, between studying psychology and the band. And so I dropped out after 1 year. And then that started a whole an uncertain period in my life because it took another year or two before we were able to write enough material to record an album, and since then things have gone well, but it was quite something for a while.
So things have gone well for you guys. How many albums have you done so far?
We just finished recording our third album, and it'll come out later this year.
Right, so you recorded it this spring, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what's in store for listeners?
Well, this is actually, I guess, technically the first time I've talked about the new album in any kind of interview form. We've been working on it for almost 2 years. We're not the fastest writers. We can talk about that later. It's a little bit interesting, I think. We wrote more material than we might have needed for a conventional record, for a bunch of reasons, to have to be able to pick from a wider pool, but also to be able to stay, hopefully stay more prolific than we've been in the past. It's been a few years since our last record. Lots of different styles, some stuff that we just wrote in the past few months, some that we've been working on for like 6 years. I feel great about the new record. I guess we'll see. At this point, we're mixing it right now. I don't really know what it is anymore. You know, it gets to a certain point. I think people who do like long term creative projects know that once you dive into it for a certain period of time, you can't see it from the outside very, very well anymore. And I think that when I get a reaction from the public, I'll know kind of more what it's about. Right now, I'm just trying to think, like, is that snare too compressed? Is that, you know, is the vocal balance right? Those kind of things.
Well, you've set the bait, so now I want to jump right into it. Maybe you can talk about what the creative process is for the band when you guys are writing and coming up with the new material.
Well, in the early days, in the early days, that's when we kind of set the, it's not a formula, but just the way that we interact as songwriters collaborating. That's the main kind of thing that characterizes, especially my experience in this group, is that it's collaborative, which is really different, I think, from just single-minded individual, creative pursuits. Devin, our lead singer, will often have some kind of little guitar lick or a vocal melody or something like that, and then it's kind of on us to respond to that and to provide counter melodies and kind of rhythmic counterpoint. I would say that the rhythm in our music is often lyrical in its own way. It has to do a lot with Dylan, our drummer, being a classically trained piano player. But anyway, like, when the initial idea, sometimes it comes from Devin, sometimes it comes from other people, gets thrown out there, it's this kind of negotiating process that where whatever you kind of hear, you try to throw that out there and offer it, and then we wrestle with it. And sometimes that process takes one afternoon and then everything kind of falls into place, and sometimes it takes years for it to kind of refine or the kind of like reduce to what the common or what the most potent elements are. I think the music often has a feeling where each voice can stand alone. You can hear it if you put headphones on, especially you can hear it stand alone. But you can also hear how it fits almost geometrically into the sonic spectrum. And that's something that we're always looking for, not kind of stepping on each other's toes. Often with guitar music, I find that, there's these kind of just blocky stacking of drums, bass, and rhythm guitar, often two rhythm guitars, lead guitar on top, and then things are just kind of stacked really like bricks on top of each other, and it can obscure things, and I find it dilutes things. So we try to stay a little bit more three-dimensional in that regard, and so that process takes a long time. And
do you guys have a sense of when something becomes a commercial success? Because you've had quite a few hits. Mm-hmm. Do you know when you have a hit? Does it feel different when you're writing it, or you just sort of put stuff out there and see what the response is?
Well, the first couple hits that we had were two songs in particular, Full Circle and Call Me in the Afternoon, way back in the early days. And in those days, we had no idea, because we didn't even have a record deal. We had never played a show. We were just jamming for each other, and we were just playing for fun. We were serious, but we were playing for fun. And so then when those songs got picked up later on the radio all over the place, we kind of would tell ourselves that we kind of knew that one worked, and so maybe similar things like that would work. But to tell you the truth, I really can't predict. And we've actually, I will admit, we have tried to write hits. In some sense, there's no shame in that. We're all trying to make a living, and like, so if you can write something that's going to get on the radio all over the place and make a bunch of money, like, that'd be great, you know. And we tried. Yeah. And it felt so rotten basically right away that it just became not feasible to carry on down that path. One time when we were recording the first album, we wrote something like that we thought might be a hit, but it felt really disingenuous. It felt really rotten. And so but then certain people that we were involved with making the record at the time on the business side of things also thought that it had the potential to be a hit. So it became a point of, it was tense, you know, they said, you have to record that thing. And at that point we were way past it. We said, no, we won't do it. And they really tried to force us to. And I remember at that point there was just the three of us. It was before Isaac had joined. And we went and sat out on this dirt road and just said, you know, we're not coming back in until you tell us that we don't have to do it. You know, not because we I guess it's one thing to say that you'll do something like that, and it's another thing to go through it. And
yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So there is, if I understand your job, a chronic tension between commercial constraints mm-hmm. and your own expression as an artist. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious how you think about that, in particular because I find, I mean, music is like magic in a way, right? It just, mm-hmm. it moves people. Mm-hmm. It helps people see new connections in their lives. Mm-hmm. It helps them feel certain ways or work through certain emotional experiences. Mm-hmm. Certainly when I was younger, I used to see a lot of concerts and mm-hmm. found the experience sometimes to be therapeutic in a way.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm just curious how you navigate that.
Yeah.
And the fact that, as you say, you need to make a living and that there are other demands on your time and energy.
Yeah, yeah. I think a few things about that. I think from the inside, since my job is as a musician, a lot of that kind of magic, it's, of course I believe in what you're saying about the magic. That's why I got into it, because I felt the same way that you're describing. But when you really try to look at it, when I look at the nuts and bolts of what I do and how the songwriting process goes and how I feel when I'm analyzing a song that we're working on, you're chasing emotional feelings, and you're trying to keep them alive inside you as you and to keep them alive inside the music. But it's not the magic is more. I think that it's something that people more assume from the outside than more than I feel from the inside. At a certain point, you know, and I also. So I think that that's kind of maybe an unconventional thing to say about, as a musician, that because like, I do hear musicians talk about how the magic of music and how, but when I think about it, it's really, I don't mean to diminish the emotional kind of value that I feel towards it, but it's more that I try to take care of the technical side of the craft, you know, and that is not so magical. You know, you have to, your fingers have to be able to do things. You have to have a certain access to harmonic access to be able to improvise effectively. And that takes work. And then when I'm trying, when you look at other styles and you try to incorporate different rhythmic motifs and harmonic motifs so that you have more of a versatile palette to work with and all that. And once you start to think about it that way, when I'm working with the band, if I hear something that, you know, I think that I might want to add this interval, or I think I might want to add this kind of rhythm, it becomes more like almost like a construction work, you know, and that you have to kind of move back and forth in your mind between that and then understanding the emotional, you know, the emotional effect that you're trying to preserve. And I think that that, so when I think about it that way, that's not so different from lots of different kinds of jobs. You know, being a teacher, you have to maintain a kind of emotional interest with your students in order to be able to teach them effectively, keep them emotionally engaged. Or, you know, during doing your job as a clinical psychologist, or you have to be able to, you know, again, your kind of professional toolkit and your kind of emotional awareness are in tune to achieve an effect. And so the music has a certain mysticism surrounding it that I don't know is necessarily unique to mm-hmm. The fine arts, you know? And so then when you relate it back to commerciality and that kind of thing. Well, I just got back from a trip to Greece, you know, and just 2 days ago, and I was looking at the Acropolis, the amazing old city. And when I think about the Acropolis, it's impossible not to think of, you know, Pericles, the statesman who ordered all those things to be built. And just like last year, we talked about how I went on a trip to Florence in Italy, and it's impossible to separate all that great art from the Medicis, who, again, kind of ordered that to be built. It was all commercial, you know? And without the kind of commercial push, the facilitation to make those things happen wouldn't be there. And so I think that there might be and I kind of have little theories that bubble up in my mind about why this might be, but that there might be a kind of a marriage in the perception of the fine arts with this kind of mystical, mystical feeling, magical feeling that isn't necessarily justified as far as I can tell.
It's a bit romanticized.
It's a bit romanticized. I think that the arts might be more similar to other walks of life than people might think.
Yeah, well, I like this, you know, the sense that you're kind of playing on two channels.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's the technical aspect that is important.
Yeah.
And if it's not there, the music will not be received in the way that you want.
Right.
But you're also tracking the emotional impact.
Right.
In parallel.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I kind of feel this conversation moving towards the way that mindfulness and creativity interact. You know, because I think both of these things have something in common, and it's kind of like they have something inversely in common, which is creativity. When we say that, there's one sense in which you can mean that word, like that has that magical, mystical kind of meaning to it. But then if you expand that to mean anything, if you're creative when you think, oh, like I have a problem with my friend and I don't know how to solve it, you know, and then you think of a new way that you can be nice to them or something like that, you know, or like my house is too messy and I know if I build these shelves, you know, there's like creativity can involve all those kinds of things. And then in parallel with mindfulness, the way I think about it, well, there's the practice of mindfulness, but then there's the kind of mindful thinking that is broader than that, right? When you just think like, just when you started to teach me about mindfulness, I started to think about the ways that everybody kind of knows this in a way, like when you take a breath, you know, take a breath and count to 10, you know, that's kind of the mindful thinking in a way, you know? And so then when I think about, where I try to draw the boundaries between mindfulness and creativity, it's hard because it's not clear when you're really engaging in a creative process versus a mindful process. It's hard to know where to draw the lines. But when I think about writing music or something like that, you kind of go back and forth between being mindful of what you're doing and then putting that aside, you know, putting the mindfulness aside in order to actually let some kind of sub-personality in, allow that to inhabit you. And you kind of play a game with that, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, I'll pick up on that. I think what's really interesting here is the sense of the appearance and disappearance of the self.
Yeah.
And an awareness of the self, right? Which is obviously a big part of meditation and also any performative activity.
Yeah.
Right? If you're going to write something, you know, creative or interesting, you have to get out of your own way and let this whole range of complex skills express itself without you interfering.
Yeah.
But then sometimes you have to sort of check back in and say, what am I doing? Am I on the right track?
Right, exactly.
And kind of evaluate or just check in with the process.
Yeah, yeah.
And interestingly, of course, there's a subtle difference between a state of mindfulness and a state of flow.
Right.
Right. And it sounds like you're talking about mindfulness as a state of self-awareness.
Right.
And then flow, you sort of lose the sense of self and you're just in the music or in the writing and can, you know, sort of
so
dialed
would you say
into
the what's the difference between mindfulness and flow in that regard? If you're in a state of flow, is that somehow different from?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's real immersion in the moment.
Yeah.
You tend to be at your most creative, have the most capacity.
Yeah.
It tends to arise when the challenge of the moment is a perfect match for your skills at the moment.
Yeah.
Whereas meditation is much more conscious, right? Mm. You can lose a sense of self, but there's a lot more awareness, I think.
Right.
And it's a broader awareness.
Right.
Of course, this is difficult to articulate, but I think people who are familiar with both can point to the two experiences and know experientially how they're different. I wonder, you spoke about how you work with the band and how your capacity for mindfulness and kind of observing in a more, maybe less impulsive way is helpful for the group creative process. But you also do a lot of stuff on your own. Mm-hmm. How does that process look?
Mm-hmm. I would say that that's more... Well, first of all, since the music became my job, there was a period of time when we were touring really heavily that it used to have the function when I was a teenager of such a strong function of being able to offer like a therapeutic release and all those kind of things that music can do for people. And that kind of got, honestly, it got tainted when it became my job. I no longer looked for, at a certain point, release it from music. I would look in other ways. So it just takes work to get back to a place where you can enjoy it in that way. And I think we've done it. That's why it's taken, frankly, a long time for us to put our new record together, because it took getting back to that place. So then I find when I do creative stuff on my own, I'm really not ambitious about it in a career sense, and I'm really not too worried about what happens with it. And so since it's largely personal in that regard at this point, maybe in the future it won't be so much so, but it's more of a process of just letting just whatever kind of sub-personality might be nagging at me or whatever, just allowing myself to explore it and just feel how that feels when you go through it. If I'm thinking about playing the piano in my apartment by myself, or and writing little things in there, or I do work writing scripts, and I do a lot of writing just, you know, with words, and just to kind of let that process be what it is in the moment, and not be so worried about canonizing it, you know, not so worried about coming up with a crystallized product that I can then share with people, because that's the side of it that has kind of worn the magic out for me, you know?
Yeah. So I was curious to ask about that. Was it, you said you were touring a lot and almost doing your job as a musician, is that what sort of killed the magic for you?
Broadly speaking, I would say yes. That makes me, when you ask that, it makes me think about what the function of music is in the first place, you know, and when I think about, I guess if I just go a few centuries back, you know, just the way that it was used as a way of expressing community, as of celebrating, of commemorating certain events, or expressing sorrow, and what it became on the tour was more like a circus almost, you know, like you become detached from the reason, although you're sustained by the fact that the reason is that other people are having that experience in the audience, you know, hopefully that they're finding meaning in what you're doing. But it's hard to stay connected to the kind of emotional impetus. And so that can be, you know, hurtful. It almost feels like a betrayal in a way when it gets to a certain point, because it doesn't feel truthful to be expressing the form of expressing the form without this kind of what the spirit underneath, you know? So that whole thing became this was a struggle that we went through. And I think, like, I don't want to sound ungrateful, you know, because I'm extremely grateful, and this, it's on us to find our way back to the emotional core of things. But, it just felt like the forms of music. It was hard to pick up a guitar again, or hard to sit down at the piano again and find expression. It felt like I needed to look elsewhere for that at a certain point. Yeah.
As a music fan, I'm always super curious to know how emotionally alive the musician on stage feels.
Yeah.
And of course, I could imagine like one of your fans finding out that you were just sort of phoning it in one night, even though you're kind of going through motions, might find that a bit disappointing.
Well, I would say that what ended up happening, because we were desperate not to phone it in, and I can't really remember very many times when we phoned it in, because what ended up happening, if I speak frankly, was that it became self-destructive, and that took on, I know, a certain interest of its own from a fan's perspective, because there was desperation in the performances, and we were drinking really heavily, and we were you know, you could see that there was kind of like blood, sweat, and tears underneath the performance. And so it was not the same. And it didn't come from the same place that the writing of the music did, but it still had all the kind of emotional power, because we just refused to kind of roll over, you know? And so as destructive as that was, I think it still had emotional truth to it, because we were really going through something. And then the structure of the song, the structure of the performance still allowed us to express that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can see how that would be you know, a problem in and of itself. That was both the expression, and then it became a separate problem of its own that needed a kind of a separate outlet of expression, you know? And it couldn't be a public performance thing at that point. It couldn't, and to me at that point, I was reacting so strongly against it that it couldn't even be music, you know? I started to take refuge in books and just time in nature, and I started to exercise more, and I tried to stop drinking so much, and that became the outlet that was I was trying to use to get away from the whole touring beast. But I wouldn't say that we phoned it in at the same time. Yeah.
So if I'm getting that, I'm understanding that there was something really frustrating about not being able to connect with the music in an authentic way, presumably because you're saying playing the same songs over and over and over again, and you sort of lost touch with the source of the creative energy. Mm. But then that frustration became like built up a life of its own, and you were in a way expressing that. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of the self-destructive piece?
It's something like that. It's something like that. I'm not sure it had necessarily to do with the repetition of playing the songs. Mm. It might have been something... A lot of touring musicians have expressed similar problems about this touring life, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, but part of it is the extent you get. First of all, I think you become desensitized to normal human social norms. You know, to have. That kind of reaction that you get from a stage is not normal, you know? And
what do you mean by that?
The way that I think about it, this fits funny because this is really silly because I've been everybody's following the NBA playoffs right now because the Raptors are doing so well, and when I watch Kawhi Leonard and the star, and he's like so stoic all the time, and it seems to be common among great athletes, often, not always, but also among, you know, really successful people a lot of the time, that it's like getting caught up in the response to the thing is a distraction from the thing itself, and the real meaning comes from following through that whole trajectory without the kind of succumbing to the little ebbs and flows along the way and looking at the bigger arc, you know, and knowing what you're really geared towards. But the thing is that when you're traveling as a touring musician, like, it's really hard to separate yourself from that kind of that like supercharged social response of a lot of people cheering for what you're doing, you know, and watching you as you stand up there and do this silly dancing stuff that you do. And so it's really a huge struggle to first of all, separate what you're doing from the judgment of it somehow. Like, oh, that was good. Good job. Cheer, cheer, clap, 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 you know. That was bad, you know, bad performance. That didn't go well. Well, it's not really the point, you know. Like, the idea is more to find the voice that you hear in your head or that you want to express, develop it as well as you can, and then confidently express it, and don't worry about what anybody thinks about it. Just do the next thing after that. Keep moving forward, you know? And so, but it's the challenge on tour is that's just really not the way it's set up. It's more set up like, here's what we're doing. Okay, clap, clap, that was good, you know? And so you get caught up in that. Then you get desensitized to that. Then you try to chase the feeling that you felt the first time that it happened. And then you don't also have like these like little mundane things, like your routine is totally disrupted. Yeah. Your sleep schedule is totally disrupted. Your diet is shit, you know, like, and so all those things add up, I guess. All those things add up.
I want to pick up on this comment about getting caught up in the feedback, right? Because, you know, understanding to the extent that I do the human brain and the needs of a human being, doing something with your hands and then 20,000 people screaming and applauding and adoring you for it has got to be among the most rewarding or even addictive things that you could do outside of drugs, although presumably, you know, a lot of musicians drink, or, you know, drugs are part of life on the road, so that's maybe even enhancing the effect. Is that what gets you caught up, is just how rewarding and how powerful a stimulus that is?
I think so. And I think the inverse is the same too. If something doesn't go well and you get that negative feeling and then you don't want that to happen again, like, it's a really powerful reinforcement system. It's really hard to especially because when I first started this, I was only 19 or 20 or whatever. And like, that's when you're the most susceptible to these, well, maybe a few years younger, even more so, but
no, you're right. That's right in
the sweet spot. You're so susceptible to what people think of you. I was a young man and I wanted to make my way, you know, and I was ambitious and I wanted to do well, and I wanted people to know I was doing well. And then when things started to go well for the band, well, I really got a, you know, huge like shot of that feeling. And I was definitely not immune to letting that to feeling what that makes you feel like, you know, like, yeah. It's like you put when it's the similar kind of feeling to when you put your really cool vacation picture on Instagram and more people like it than ever before and whatever, you know, that feels great, you know, or yeah. You take a risk with some other kind of photo and like nobody comments or whatever, then it's like, you know, it feels really bad.
So if I want to feel what it's like to like play a guitar solo on stage in front of 50,000 yeah. people, I should just put like a cool picture of myself on Instagram and hope yeah. a lot of people like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just a little bit more amplified.
It's just more amplified, I think. Yeah. Well, and then in terms of the drinking thing and all that, the drugs part of it, it's like one thing's for sure is that if you feel that feeling while you've been drinking, that your brain is going to tell you, you know, keep drinking, because that seems to go really, really great. Right. Those things get linked up too, and I think that's why addiction and music, musicians, it's such a, you know, the emotional response is just so strong that those things become just hardwired together. You mm-hmm. know,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you talked about trying to find your way back,
yeah,
to connecting with the sort of the source or like the kind of authentic
yeah.
dynamic of creating and performing music.
Yeah.
And you talked about going back into nature and getting away from music. How did the process go of finding your way back?
It was messy. It was really messy because that became kind of the point where maybe if you compare it to a relationship, that when a relationship is going badly, you'll be susceptible to doing little things that will destroy it, you know, subconscious things that will destroy it. And some stuff like that was happening, I think, within the band at a certain point, that we knew something was not going right. We didn't really have control over it. It seemed like our job was to keep the machine going. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of other people involved, a lot of other people getting paid. And so it took a kind of a messy process of self-evaluation to get back on track. And there was like we had some fights within the band, not necessarily about that, but definitely related to that. And it was kind of the Phoenix thing, you know, we burned everything down in order to see what remained, you know. And there was a point to see that I thought that I think we were all open to seeing if we really we're open to this not going forward, you know, we're open to this not going forward. So let's see what that looks like in our mind, and let's see and just really explore that, really imagine that and see what's left. And then luckily, when we really examined that, and when I really examined that for myself as well, it took months, but it looked like at the bottom, there was still some work to be done between us. You know, there was still something that we wanted to say. There was still collaborating that seemed like would be meaningful. And the bond that we had musically seemed to be worth whatever else we had to sacrifice going forward. And that felt really truthful. And so from that place, we were able to rebuild again. And from, I think it could only really come from that place. I really think that if we had kept just trying to push the machine forward, that it would have eventually exploded and totally, it would have totally ended. Mm-hmm. And so from then we were really able to rebuild. It had to do with airing out all our grievances between each other. It had to do for me a lot with refining my skill set again and really practicing my instrument and I spent like a year practicing the piano and reading everything I could get my hands on to feel like a confident person again, you know, to feel like I wasn't just someone that would go out and do the same old dance every night, that I had new ideas and that I was a more mature person and that I had something to say that wasn't just pantomime or something, you know. And so it was kind of a maturation process, I would say. I felt really like I've kind of became a man, like I was crystallized in a teenage state, because I was 19 when it first started happening. And it was like when that happened, it was like a snapshot of me was taken developmentally and in every sense, you know. And that was taken and it was just dragged across the road for like 3 or 4 years, and I wasn't allowed to, not that I wasn't allowed, but I wasn't able to let my life continue, you know. And so it was really upsetting to at a certain point look at myself and realize like wow, like I might have lost a few years of my own growth here, you know, like that's depressing and or it's horrifying, you know. But then to realize after that, well, I can definitely still do something about this, and the people that I'm working with and collaborating with are in the same circumstance, and so we can do this together. Mm. And then maybe we can still write around that, you know. Maybe that can be our inspiration, and so those all became kind of points of hope. And so hopefully the new record reflects some of that, you know. Hopefully we didn't screw it up. Yeah.
Yes, it's a very interesting kind of narrative arc, right? Over the last, what, 2-3 years maybe, or more?
Mm-hmm. About 3 years.
3 years. Mm-hmm. And you sort of arrived at this, I don't know, new equilibrium or something. So you have this new wisdom, you have this new sense of how to take care of yourself and how to take care of the band. I'd be curious to hear, and of course, this is a challenge for a lot of people, right? You go through something, you learn, you figure it out. Now, how do I sustain? Mm-hmm. How do I sustain myself? How do I maintain the gains?
Yeah.
Right? So you have to take care of yourself in a way so that you can keep growing, keep going as a person. Mm-hmm. You have to nurture the talent that you have or the skill set that you have. That's how you're going to earn a living and, mm-hmm. and have some level of fulfillment in your life. Mm-hmm. What are the key elements or the key practices you're going to try to maintain both for yourself and maybe even for the band going forward?
Yeah.
Because chances are, I mean, you guys have a big tour coming up.
Yeah, really big.
There's tour. You're going all through the summer and into the fall. And
yeah, it's
going
to go on from there
too. All over the world.
Yeah.
What are you doing to set yourself up for success for the next round?
Yeah, although that's a great question. And I'm nervous about it because I haven't really done an extensive tour since 2016 or so, 2015. So I'm nervous. I know the demons to avoid, you know, I know the things to avoid. One thing that I've been thinking just recently, and I was just talking to Devin, the singer, earlier today about it, there's things that performance-wise that you dread, that songs that you feel like you don't want to play because they're difficult and this kind of thing, and that can often... That's just a little thing, but just to try to treat the things that have caused you trouble in the past, like a project that once you get past that, you can that will cause, you know, more meaning in your experience, and not be afraid of the things that you've been afraid of in the past. And a lot of it's just behavioral stuff, you know, and really mm-hmm. controlling the schedule. And the things that I'm worried about are basically being able to keep myself healthy. Like, that's the main thing. Not drink too much, not let my diet get too bad, make sure that the sleep stuff doesn't get out of control. Because from there, really, it's kind of seems mundane, but everything can slide away as soon as little things can become big things when your physical health is not taken care of. And I think from there, because the next thing I would say is to try to keep my mind engaged in engaged creatively one way or another with books or with instruments or with whatever on the road. That's crucial, so you don't feel like you're just stagnating on the road. So health comes before that, because health comes first, and it's important. Beyond that, like I said, I'm a little bit nervous. I'm just gonna try to stay aware and watch for what problems may arise. I still don't know how the record's going to be received. I'm optimistic about it, so I don't know really what the touring experience is going to be like. It feels like I'm about to, I'm just about to get on the boat and go to sea for 18 months, in the 18th century or something. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what people I'm going to encounter, so I don't know.
I'm going to bring us back to some of the territory we covered earlier on in the discussion. I'm wondering how you see mindfulness helping you through the tour and life on the road and kind of sustaining yourself.
I don't know if this is something that other people that practice mindfulness do too. Maybe you can tell me. But when I first started practicing, I developed a framework that it's almost like when you have a little problem after that, after having practiced for a little while, then you can just kind of shoot your mind into a mindfulness snapshot for a second. And then you think, oh yeah, you know, kind of like that. Like, you don't need to necessarily sit there and meditate every time. And so to me, that process right there, it just if you're, oh, there's a problem. Okay, what about the mindfulness thing? Then you go boom, and you have a shot, right? And then you start to remember things that are often like, oh yeah, what's my objective? What is that feeling? You know, what is that person feeling? You know, like, what is this sensation telling me? You know, rather than inhabiting the sensation, you ask what it's telling you. And asking that question takes like a fraction of a second, right? Mm-hmm. And so that for me has become kind of the essence of what mindfulness means, is just that little snapshot that it gives, you know? So that's why I stumble with my words a little bit about it sometimes, because I know I don't have the definition of mindfulness quite right. I have a kind of personal relationship with that exact thing that I just described. Maybe most people have their own personal relationship with these things too.
What you just described is incredibly clear and a beautiful experiential kind of description of how mindfulness is sort of brought online in real life.
Right.
It's the idea is not that one meditates through a problem. The idea is that the meditation practice is there so that in the moment where something difficult comes up, the capacity to step back and take the snapshot, as you say, is more readily available.
Right, right.
So you sound like a lot of the people that I teach meditation to. I guess I'm curious if mindfulness is useful in any way in the process of creativity, whether it's your own personal creativity or with the band.
Yeah, right. So then building on what I just, the way I just described it, just those snapshots, I'd say it's valuable in that way, incorporating those, that snapshot. Like you kind of mentioned, I forget what the study was called, but when they actually do brain scans of people who are told to improvise and whatever,
Maybe I'll just briefly introduce that. So there's some very cool brain imaging studies done with jazz musicians who were improvising in scanner. Mm-hmm. And I believe there was a very strong deactivation of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Whether that's the brain region or not, the interpretation was that these musicians are incredibly good at shutting down their sense of self-consciousness, self-criticism, or self-analysis, and they're just fully immersed in the moment and letting whatever creative skill they have just express itself with ease. Mm-hmm. So, it's not clear that that's necessarily a mindful state.
Yeah, but that's what I'm just thinking.
Yeah,
that's
go ahead.
Closer to a state of flow, maybe.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the difference between those things, that would be more for the experts to talk about. But it seems like the concept of kind of shooting back and forth between these different kinds of states, between different levels of self-awareness. Not to make it sound all esoteric or anything, it's just that you're allowing yourself to be inhabited just totally in the music, or you're kind of checking back in to see what's happening, to check your direction and maybe make a recalibration, and then to re-immerse yourself. And that happens like really in the fraction of a second. And it's not even clear whether it's not always clear to me whether or not it's even useful to be aware that that's what's happening, right? Uh-huh. Like, because you don't always want to know how the sausage is made, you know? Like, I think about great geniuses when I think about, like, you know, I'm thinking about Miles Davis or something. Like, there's no way that guy was, you know, like, well, I don't know. Who knows what he was thinking, but or what his brain was doing. But we're not all Miles Davis. And so it has been useful for me to it feels like another tool in my arsenal, you know, another weapon that I have that I can, when I started practicing mindfulness, it kind of put more of a name to that process of kind of stepping outside your experience and taking a snapshot, and then to be able to have that just kind of really in your tool belt for when you might need it, especially helpful when you're collaborating, but even on your own, even on my own, I'm thinking like, you might be stuck up against a wall, you know, and then just to step back and just, oh, you realize that you've gone down a kind of a rabbit hole here, and so then you go back to what worked, and so it can help you. I think mindfulness can help organize your creativity, maybe. And
so I had this guy Pete Kirchmer on the podcast recently. He trains elite athletes, among other people, in mindfulness. And for elite athletes and other peak performers, being able to be totally immersed in the moment and not be self-conscious and not be overcome by stress or anxiety is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And these people are really focus on having flow in their performance. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure as a musician, you experience flow quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And the idea with this kind of training is to use mindfulness to help set the conditions for flow. Mm-hmm. And the sort of little pithy statement for it is to say, flow sort of emerges by accident, and mindfulness just makes you more accident prone.
I think that's great. I think that's a really great way of putting it. A really great way of putting it. It really reminds me of that the athletic kind of comparison that I made earlier, because I think that the more that I found, the more that I prepare for a moment, and usually that moment for me is the moment of collaboration with the band when we all get into the room together. The more I can prepare for that in advance with just getting all the different kind of tools that you need it can just be practicing scales, it can be practicing mindfulness, it can be just reflecting quietly about something else, or going to a museum or whatever. And then all those things, you know, it makes you feel like you have kind of just some substance, some content, you know, that and when you get into a moment that you're prepared to disperse it in ways that, you know, are free and open, and you can feel levity in that moment from your preparedness, you know?
I learned something interesting. I did a contract with Pete actually recently, I did a training with some Canadian Olympic athletes. And during the Q&A at the end, one of the athletes said, you know, when I first started practicing mindfulness, I found my performances actually got worse.
Okay.
And that was, you know, we were a little concerned to hear that because we were trying to introduce people to this practice and get them excited about it and stuff. And his comment was that he just became more self-conscious around his performances.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's pretty common when one is first learning to practice that this sort of sense of self sort of gets in the way.
Yeah.
But again, as one develops the skill more deeply, the awareness can be used to, again, sort of set the conditions, right? And I found it interesting because you were talking about when you're on the road, making sure you're taking care of your sleep, making sure you're taking care of your diet, stuff to maintain your basic capacities so that obstacles like fatigue or feeling malnourished or whatever don't get in the way.
Right.
I also really like this comment you made about stepping out, taking the mindful snapshot, making whatever adjustments are needed, whether it's to your lifestyle or behavioral routines or to music, right? And then you dive right back in.
Exactly. It's been a super valuable tool in that way. There's for sure.
Kind of switching channels a little bit here, I'm curious to get your sense of what it's like to be in the role of a celebrity. Now, obviously, you're not, I don't know, a Kardashian.
No.
Last I checked. But you are a public figure, pretty well known. And obviously, the celebrity lifestyle has a lot of trappings or has a lot of pitfalls when it comes to mental health and well-being. I'm wondering how you navigate, like what you experience as a celebrity and how you navigate that and sort of maintain a level head.
Well, yeah, you're right. I'm definitely not even close to the level of where my privacy is really that big of a problem, or I can go anywhere I want, you know, and I can enjoy my time without it. When people come up to me in the street, it really only happens most of the time. It just happens in Quebec, and they just have something really nice to say. So it's really pleasant in that way. But so the main pitfall for me has been just that feeling like the things that you do are so subject to a judgment, a value judgment, you know, because it's such a distraction. It's such an unhealthy distraction, I find. I've heard somebody say, I think it's almost a cliche now that with the way that social media is, everyone's like their own little celebrity, you know, because I think that's something that has to do something with like that, is that everything that you do is kind of idealized, and then a value judgment is placed on it, literally, like, you know, or people comment that it's great or something. And that's just not the most important thing. In fact, it's far from the most important thing. Those are idealized micro moments that are then used as checkpoints to represent your experience, or represent your, or, and then they're lined up, and your the story of your life kind of becomes based on that somehow. You know, I'm exaggerating, but there's a sense in which that's true. And then when you start to become known by more people, your life becomes even more idealized, and the value judgments, for better or for worse. Well, I think even if it's ostensibly for better, it's still long-term for worse, because the more that you kind of accept that as a story of your life, the less ownership that you have over your life, and just the more, like, really, if I did something on a record or on stage or whatever that you think is great, well, that's great, but it's not like me feeling like you think that is great is going to make me that's not what led me there in the first place. It was my whole childhood and everything that I did in my life led me there. And so then to try to, you're tempted to replicate things that people liked and that they told you that they liked, and to avoid things that they told you that they didn't like. And then as soon as you start playing that game, you're in big trouble. You're in big trouble. And so the way to navigate that is not always clear, because just you have to be real with yourself and to acknowledge that, well, no, you like the feeling. You like the feeling of that acceptance, and you hate the feeling that comes from people disapproving of something that you've done. You can't just block it out. You can't, it's complicated. The way that I've tended to deal with it, well, we've been away for a few years, so I've been just like kind of in a retreat, and I feel more ready than ever to deal with that kind of thing. But it's just been to find one thing that I know is a good outlet, and then just to kind of, it's another kind of just a behavioral solution, and mm-hmm. just engage in that.
What's an example of that?
An example of that would be if you start to feel yourself susceptible towards if I start to feel like I know that practicing the piano is a good thing to do, is a good thing to do. So if I'm in my house and I'm staring at Instagram, or if I'm just having thoughts about myself as a certain kind of person, I know that if I just start practicing the piano, that's going to be good. That's just an example. I use exercise in that way. I use talking to my parents in that way. I use writing in my journal in that way. And so if any one of those things is at my fingertips, when this any kind of thought process along these lines that I'm describing emerges, that I just turn to the other thing, and that tends to engage me in more of a long-term arc rather than a kind of a short-term pleasure boost or whatever that might be. So I would just try to, I guess it's a matter of looking, you could be mindful about it. You try to look back and see, what's my goal? Where am I aiming here? Am I trying to aim at being the most accepted by the most amount of people, or just start to ask yourself those questions, and then hopefully you can avoid the trappings. Yeah.
I wonder if this is, like, you're going to give a similar answer. I'm curious about the tendency for the constraints of the business side of things to influence your experience of being a musician and even the creation of music. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate the demands of the commercial side of things, knowing that you need to make a living, mm-hmm. and it's probably fun to have a radio hit? Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've definitely learned, although it's not always easy to remember, but I've learned through real concrete experience in my life that every single time you try to do what the business thinks it wants from you, it doesn't know what it wants. The business doesn't know the business analytical side of things is it's too analytical for its own good. The more that you can find the emotional core of what you're trying to say, the more it will relate to the most people. And so it is a really similar answer. I found that making this record, there has been pressure from the business side of things. We have great business partners, and so I'm not talking specifically about anybody, but what the tendency is in the business side of the music industry, and I think this is true about most industries, is to look at what has worked and then look at what this new product is trying to do and compare it to what has worked, and then to try to adjust it to make it fit more into what has worked. And that's not the realm that creative people occupy. The realm that creative people occupy when they're at their best is to provide new examples of what works, and then maybe other people want to imitate it or maybe not. But it helps to have good collaborators that you trust, that when these difficult moments come up and people are asking for something, asking for changes, that not coming from the right place, that you can look to each other for support. And I'm fortunate to have that in the band. But it's a similar kind of thing you try to ask yourself, what's the purpose of trying to make something, commercially comparable to other things like it, you know? Well, that's not what I'm in the business of doing, you know? I'm in the business of trying to take whatever I feel and to express it in a musical way, you know? Like that's and that if I'm doing that, I have business success as well, because I'm not against business success. I'm not against making money or any of that. Even if you want to look at it from a strictly business perspective, I could take my own. I could make you a chart that says that how many times I tried to follow like a business analytical path that somebody else laid out for me, and how many times that worked out, especially in the long term. You know, it's a bad idea for the business. You know, yeah.
But it's not like every time somebody expresses some emotion authentically, it turns into a commercial success. Mm-hmm. So there's some level of uncertainty there, right?
Right, right, right. That's a great point. That's a great point. The little rant I just went on there, it's expressing kind of an exaggerated version of one side of it, because of course, mm-hmm. as a creative person, you're also realistically comparing yourself to other things, because that's kind of how you, I don't know, there's a friendly competition even that you can use to you know, well that was a really musically, you know, that was a really, you heard some other record, that was a really provocative, emotionally risky take on something, and then you think, well, oh, I didn't realize that was acceptable. Maybe I can push it even further, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's those kind of things to think of. There's also just, again, I keep coming back to it, but there's the technical proficiency of the thing, and right. you know you can't. You know, I think of Yoko Ono or something. You know, it's like maybe that's an authentic kind of emotional expression, but it sure isn't very refined, and it sure isn't very pleasant. You know, I don't know why I brought her. But there has to be other elements other than just, you know, that kind of, you know, raw emotional purity. Right. You know, yeah.
And there are a lot of very successful artists. Commercially successful artists that don't have very much talent.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe I should have more nuance there. Presumably some level of artistic ability is required. You have to pass a certain threshold, although in the history of pop music, mm-hmm. I'm sure there are borderline exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you think about the technical aspect, right? Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's an edge for you. It keeps you growing and keeps you interested, keeps you in flow. Mm-hmm. But is that really necessary to be successful?
Again, that's a good question. I think that part of why I say that is because I'm a bit reactionary myself against what I perceive in the current musical landscape to be a real neglect towards that side of things. My genre, roughly speaking, indie rock, I think that there's, frankly, a lot of slackers in my genre. I don't think that people learn how to play their guitars properly, and I think that the musicianship is just not at a very good level, and I think that that's one way that we can set ourselves apart, and that's also something that I think is... Well, I think it's important. When I think about the musicians, like I think back to the 60s and 70s and the bands that were happening around then, like, you know, people just can't really play the guitar like Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page and people like that anymore. You know, there's something missing. Part of it is that they really made their bones when they were developing their chops, you know. There was a cultural moment that they were able to take advantage of and all those kinds of things. But no, I do think it's important. But then I also know that when it becomes too much, you know, too stuffy, you know, too rigid, that it's really valuable for the counterwave to come and wash it all away and to have something more rough, you know, something a little more rock and roll or whatever, you know. Like, I love the music from the 50s too, which is like, you know, that's Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley all reacting against, you know, how much is that doggy in the window, and you know, that really stuffy kind of post-war music and whatever, and so both are valid. I guess mainly why I would focus on the technical side of things right in this moment is because I really feel like, especially in my genre, it's something that's lacking.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you guys are working on the album now, getting it out soon, hitting the road. Mm-hmm. What's in store more in the long run? And I'm not necessarily asking for your specific life plans, mm-hmm. but what is it that's going to nurture you in the long run in terms of your life as an artist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty in this job and in this life. And I have no idea what my life is going to be like in 10 years or even 5 years. If I'm speaking honestly, I really don't know. I really don't know. I want to have a family one day, but I want to stay active in the creative arts, but I'm interested in all kinds of things. I guess right in this moment, I'm more thinking along the lines of what can I say? You know, a lot of the journey that I've been on in the past 3 or 4 years has led me to a kind of place where now, mm-hmm. it's different. I'm not in a state of turmoil right now, you know, and I'm not in a state of trying to claw my way up a ladder at this moment. I've just finished making the record, and I feel like I'm just watching to see what's going to come next, you know, and I want to be able to watch and react to things. And I don't really feel like I have such a mountain in front of me in this exact moment. And so... I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going to come next.
Yeah. Spoken like a true practitioner. Connor, is there anything else you want to add? Anything we didn't touch on you think is important for this conversation?
Well, I'm happy with what we've covered, although I would say that I'm really excited by the field that you occupy and the... not just mindfulness, but I know a little bit about the directions that your business is expanding into and that the field is expanding into. And I think it's really amazing. It's the way that kind of meditation practice and is linking up with really advanced neuroscience and a lot of the stigmas about things like, you know, psilocybin research and one thing and another, that those are all kind of fusing and coming into this place. It feels like an accelerating field of study, you know, and I think it's really helping a lot of people. It really helped me, and so I'm thrilled to see where it's going to go in the next few years. I hope it does as well as how I feel like it can do, you know.
That's awesome. Thank you for saying that. Before we sign off here, maybe I can just give you a moment to just talk about where people can hear your music and come see you live and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're working with really advanced marketing metrics now, so it's going to come into your Instagram feed whether you like it or not. But if you do want to go look for it, just halfmoonrunner.com is where all our tour dates will be listed, and we're on social media and all over the internet.
Cool. All right, Connor, thank you so much for doing this. This has been really fun.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Mindspace Podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more mind space, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.